You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Family Matters.
20 minutes after 11 o'clock, it is Family Matters time. And as I've said at the beginning and a couple of times this morning, we're going to be focusing on eating disorders and the secret truths about eating disorders. I hope that you will enjoy, as I know that you probably will, because he's excellent. Hayden Nibbs, who's a clinical psychologist, as we talk about our very complex but also fascinating relationships that we have about with food. And many people, this is a struggle. Some people have other kinds of addictions, for example, behavioral addiction, and maybe, speaking of technology and society, technological these days. For others, it may be hard drugs, maybe substance abuse that you are struggling with. But there's also a spectrum of different kinds of disorders when it comes to eating, eating per se, but also obviously therefore our relationship with food. And Hayden and I thought this is one topic that actually I don't think we've spoken about on the show before, and I hope that you will find it of some help. If you want to call in throughout, the number is going to be open between now and noon on 011-883-0702. Hayden, good morning to you.
Morning.
Did you have a good breakfast?
Indeed, yes. Beautiful.
This is this is such an important topic. You're going to die if you don't eat. Everyone does need to eat. And yet eating and food can be such an incredibly complex part of our psychosocial well-being.
Indeed. And that's really the key to it all, because all of us, anyone that is alive on the planet, eats. We all need food, and so we all really have some sort of a degree of a relationship with food. But there really is pockets, and I'm aware all the listeners out there have probably heard the psychiatric diagnoses for these types of things. But let's simplify it a bit and look at the clinical processes behind. Mm-hmm. If we separate it, we start with two general umbrellas, the one being individuals who overeat and the other being individuals who undereat. Really just looking at it like that, if we zoom in a little bit, I would definitely certainly have to separate the two. So let's begin with the umbrella of undereating. Mm-hmm. Essentially, there what we find clinically, and this is, I just want to emphasize, this is what we find very often, because human beings are so unique. There is always outliers, clinical differences, or a process different that we find. But classically speaking, I would say there we can even see from a young age an individual who subjectively really struggles within their environment, feels subjective feelings of judgment, high levels of judgment, really not feeling very understood, or really having very little gap for vulnerability, almost a bit trapped in that sense, unable to control it, really feeling left out and out of control. Mm. What we find there is almost in a pushback to try and gain a bit of control and gain a bit of acceptance, what really does develop is this relationship with food in which it is limited so that one can control one's weight. There's one powerfully important element clinically speaking. What happens here is over time, one chooses, let's say you are controlling the intake of food, your weight is really, really low. It reaches a point where people start giving you feedback that you are now too thin. The challenge here is there is on a level, and I'll carry on, there's different levels at play, but on a level there is a feeling of achievement. And there we run the risk of sealing off information from the world. We refer to it a bit as being a closed system. In essence, it is a difficulty in accepting feedback from outside. And there, the person becomes unreachable. So all of the input is rejected, and their own view is chosen above. Here, what runs the risk is a skewed view and a misunderstanding of what one's body looks like, actually a real distortion in perception. And that is trapping in this kind of a situation.
That's quite interesting. I always thought, as someone who's had a complex relationship and still does with food, that there's this interplay between my body in the world and my inner emotional landscape. So it's not so much that I'm not watching out for feedback outside of this closed system within my own psychology, but then the world tells me, you're too thin, you're too fat. And I take that to heart. And then I have food for every emotion.
Indeed.
I've had a good day at the office. Well, let me grab the pasta. I've had a bad day at the office. Let me grab the pasta. Mm. And it's the perfect argument. Whatever premises you use, it ends in pasta must be ordered.
Indeed.
And before you know it, you're spiraling out of control and you have either a million and one diets that you go through and your body weight yo-yos. And you have a high level of knowledge, but there's a gap between knowledge and behavior because the psychological stuff intervenes to stop you from behaving the way you do when you reflect on how you should behave. But our reflective self and the self that reaches for that last bite, or not the last bite, the entire box of chocolates.
Yes.
Those are almost like two different selves in us. So speak into that for me.
Beautiful.
And as you do so, is there a difference between someone who has a complicated relationship with food, as I'm casually calling it, and a clinical disorder per se?
Yes. From what you're referring to, really tiptoes on the other umbrella, the umbrella of overeating. Under this umbrella, we have very similar clinical elements in the sense that they, from typically, again, there is exceptions, but let us say typically, we have another environment that is subjectively hostile, judgmental per se. One feels like they do not fit. However, what we find when it comes to that kind of a mechanism, sometimes we find a struggle to put forward boundaries in the individual. Here we have somebody that really takes a knock, sometimes actually understands others and is softer to it, but they don't draw a boundary, a barrier. Now we have, when it comes to just the act of eating, physiologically, when we are eating, we do not experience anxiety. So there is a subjective relief momentarily. So we run the risk of conditioning in binging. When we binge excessively, there is a momentary release. In that sense, for that period of time, that boundary and that pushback from the pain in the environment is relieved momentarily. Obviously, there, as you're alluding to as well, there is addictive elements there. There's a mechanism of escapism. Addiction in itself is a huge psychology. Let me not delve too deep. We certainly can at a topic, but let's just touch on it. There's that relief for a period. And when we almost return, it is worsened because the solution becomes the problem in a sense, gaining weight. That umbrella of overeating, it does not necessarily mean one would become overweight, because there's other people that will overeat and then immediately purge. So there we have, but the act of overeating, let us say someone ends up overweight and it really is a battle for them. We find that overeating release. So it really caters for where one is struggling a bit to put down to push back on different levels. It's almost a different logical level that one gets that relief from. An additional challenge that you refer to, that I see very rarely, if ever, touched on in the texts. When it comes to overeating, if an individual ends up overweight, there is such a pain behind that, because in addition comes a group dynamic that very often they are actually discarded, even their opinions. They are literally separated from other groups, and they are labeled because of that.
Absolutely.
An extreme, extreme rejection, where, of course, in turn plays back into the mechanism itself. Almost impossible to deal with that in interaction. then again comes in the temptation, and there sits such a painful, painful process.
Wonderfully put. Pardon Hayden's pun on catering. 11:30, I'd love to hear from you. Do you struggle with your relationship with food? And what does that mean for you? Overeating? Do you eat too little? Do you struggle to put on weight? What does that do to, what do you see when you look into the mirror? Your relationship consequently with your body? Are you someone who eats because you get that momentary relief or what you think is a dose of serotonin, only moments later maybe to purge? And have you got questions for our clinical psychologist in that regard? Food is something we can't run away from as social beings. Maybe in your line of work, you are exposed to it all the time. You're about to go on lunch right now. I wonder how many of you already have trepidation about a business lunch that you might be going to and wondering what you're going to order because of that silent, complicated relationship that you have with food. I'd love to hear from you. And any way in which we can help you, Hayden Nibbs, our clinical psychologist, is here to answer your questions. 011-883-0702.
Family Matters.
25 minutes before noon, we're talking about eating disorders. Are you struggling with one? Or maybe you're not sure whether you have an eating disorder. Maybe you're not sure whether you're just struggling with weight. I mean, there's lots of questions here, right? There's a clinical disorder, and then they're simply thinking like, maybe I'm just eating too much. I must just stop having so many carbs. But you've got stubborn fat, and maybe you think, I don't know, it's slow metabolism. I'm now 40. It can be very, very hard to get a grip on your own physical well-being and mental health as well. And that's exactly why we have Hayden Nibbs here. So any and all questions relating to eating disorders, give us a call on 011-883-0702. I've got a couple of practical questions. When it comes to weight loss specifically,
yes,
you know, sometimes there are all sorts of things that can make it hard to shed off the extra pounds. Could be that you're on chronic medication that affects you. Could just be genetic luck or bad or good luck where you struggle to lose weight because maybe everyone in your family, there's a propensity towards obesity, say, for example. Or you're just not doing enough cardio. Or aging causes your metabolism, for example, to slow down. Or sometimes a combination of the above. How does one know at what point you should speak to either your GP or to your clinical psychologist?
Yeah.
All you know is that secretly when you are naked in the bathroom and you're looking at yourself, you're unhappy with your body, and you know that when you make choices to eat, you have a long internal monologue about what to eat, what not to eat, but you're unsure whether you're just going through everyday trials and tribulations that the average Joe or Josephine goes through, or whether you're actually someone who maybe should see a professional, whoever, be it your clinical nutritionist or your psychologist.
Beautiful. I will say, let us start here. Disorder speaking, there is obviously a list of symptomology that's used to diagnose. But let's just simplify a little bit so we can kind of understand it. The symptomology, essentially, the overeating one kind of goes into one broad category of losing control and binging. So one really struggles to stop and then feels a profound shame afterwards. The undereating, if it is the constant focus, the only thing that one, well, not the only thing, but let's say a vastly high level of focus on food, on body image, all of this kind of intake. There we are looking a bit at the symptomology. Let me add in, there is classically very, very high levels of anxiety. This is actually connected to another element that I also want to put a bit on the table here. In both cases, the relationship with food really starts to develop a secret nature.
Okay.
Where one will eat in secret or put forward a different picture. This isolates to a profound degree that creates a lot of suffering.
Or the opposite, I would imagine, when you talk about purging. I look like I'm having a good time at the table.
Indeed.
Then I excuse myself because secretly I'm going to go and put a feather at the back of my throat so I can vomit.
Exactly. The true picture is hidden. All of that being said, I always like to put forward to every individual out there, our experience of our world is subjective. If you are hearing what I'm saying and you think, oh, maybe it's me, maybe it's not me, I don't. I will always rather use the rule of thumb. If you truly are sitting with a discomfort and a bother, mm-hmm. whether it be anxiety, whether it be a concern, whether it be a profound, profound haunting or a deep pain, anything, if you reach the point that you subjectively are suffering, it is there that one can always go and seek assistance. That is certainly where I personally prefer to draw the line rather than getting too technical about the details.
Mm. In South Africa specifically, do we know what prevalence levels are like? And are there subgroups in the overall population that are particularly susceptible to them of some of the most common eating disorders? There are many moms and dads who worry about, or siblings, or people who have youngsters entrusted into their care, who worry, for example, what impact popular culture continue to have on myths around the perfect body, the healthy body, and particularly in teenagers. Mm. They may not be listening right now, but the adults in their life might be listening.
Yeah.
Are they, do we still have that problem? Because it seems to me, and I could be wrong here, just in terms of public discussion around whether someone could be bulimic, whether someone could have a whole range of the other eating disorders that we used to speak about with gay abandon. I think we've stopped kind of doing so, which would be surprising to me, because I would imagine also the kind of potential narcissism and social pressure that comes with social media.
Indeed.
Where you are expected to parade this
yes.
beach body ready and perfect body must exacerbate in modernity the susceptibility of all of us to the pressure to have the perfect body.
Yeah, that is exactly correct. With the context, the social environment that we see adapting in that way, the access to social media, it really does. My personal experience is within my practice that there is really a high prevalence. I must be honest, you have me a bit stumped at the actual rates. I'm not actually sure what the prevalence is currently in South Africa. Compared, to the norm level around the world. I must say that typically the under-eaters really, as well the over-eaters, there's such a secrecy with it. Mm. It is such a trap. It's so hard to seek assistance. In that secret nature as well, and I really want to put this forward, if it is the only thing that people take from what I'm saying, it will be enough for me. The real hook is that isolation. There's a bubble around that seals in the relationship with food specifically. If we talk, if we share with people, if they start to hear, if there is empathy around it, that is already the first step that will shift the entire picture.
Hmm.
So I really will urge individuals that are struggling, that are sitting with anxiety about it, to start to approach others in your environment that you feel can listen and really start to talk.
18 minutes before noon, I, to that end, would like to hear from you. Do you eat too much? And if you do you understand, or so you think, why you might be doing so? Hayden talks beautifully about a very dangerous notion of secrecy in relation to certain relationships that many of us have with food, secretly eating more then you are pretending. So there you are on Instagram pretending to have a salad at your restaurant, but on your way home, you are actually stopping by the drive-through Nando's or KFC, for example. Is that part of your pattern of behavior and you understand it? And equally, maybe you feel the pressure to eat whatever your host gives you, but you want to be as thin as possible and you don't quite know what drives that, but you do know that you take laxatives, you might take other things, you may be obsessive at gym to try and get rid of the bride that you were eating over the weekend from where you were invited to, you didn't want to be antisocial. What are some of those behaviors? Let's talk about them honestly, because our relationships with food are as complex as some of the other phenomena we've discussed in Family Matters. You can either leave us a voice note on 072-702-1702 or give us a call on 011-883-0702.
702.
Family Matters.
Many people are emotional eaters. Mm. Well, that's a phrase we've used since the 80s.
Indeed.
And that's because I know very few other than people who have other kinds of problems, like some of your gym bunnies, who manage to get themselves to have incredibly functional relationships with food, which some days I aspire to it because I wouldn't mind losing, you know, some body fat myself. But I just can't imagine having that kind of very simple relationship when you eat as much as you need just to be able to do the other things that matter to you. Mm. But anyone who is, not to judge those people who eat clean, as they say, but anyone who has a half interesting, I think, social life, professional life, food has a place in our life from a cultural identity point of view, business transactions that happen over food, hanging out with your friends, with family. That's so complex socially and psychologically. I can't imagine having a really dull, functional relationship with food. So how do we navigate the complex range of emotions that come with eating?
Beautiful. And you know, I really want to echo what you say. It's such a dynamic variable to investigate is our relationships with food. We're now primarily talking about extreme relationships, but if we really just zoom out a little bit, if we remove the judgment, there is really no right or wrong. There is always consequences. Mm. Certain relationships, let's say, with food will bear different consequences. If one, as you term it, eats clean, I'm gleaning that one will not eat anything that would put on excess weight.
That is fun.
Yes, indeed. But there one would, and rightly so, there is such delicate elements to food. There is a sharing that one can have around food. There is a care that one can give in cooking for someone. There is an ability to shared experience. There is a bonding. There is so much that can be around it. So it is not one that can be viewed. Food is not such a thing, in my view, that can be viewed just with a snapshot and say right or wrong. Mm. But there is, of course, consequences. If one gets into, as you termed, comfort eating, to a degree, one may do this. It is when one does it so habitually that the consequence creates massive guilt, massive suffering, massive regret, and a subjective feeling that one cannot even control it but wishes one could. There becomes that horrible trap of suffering. Mm. Again, if one is not suffering, if one is loving it and enjoying it, there is no right or wrong. There is no judgment behind it. There is simply consequences of one's behavior.
That's a very good point. I think what makes it particularly hard is information overload in relation to what is good for us.
Ah.
It's also very difficult to know what choices should I make that are optimal for my individual health.
Yeah.
The one day beet is all the rage. The next day it's not. The one day you're told, you know, high protein diets, low fat, the right kinds of fat is good for you. The next day you're told, no, fat is actually horrible for you. Then sugar is in, then it is out.
Yeah.
Then dairy is in, then we are all lactose intolerant for 5 minutes. Then you are told dairy is bad for your sinusitis. I mean, you know, before you know it, under the heap of information, you find yourself munching a burger instead.
Absolutely. And this is such a battle. I really wish I could give you an answer of what was good dietary habits. That is outside of my scope of expertise. But I agree with you.
The one thing that is clear to me, which is why I do think it is appropriate that we have you as a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
I find, and I know that many people will agree with me anecdotally as the customers or the patients, whatever you call us when we go to you as dietitians. Some people lack knowledge.
Yes.
And when they have knowledge, that's a breakthrough moment for them. And they have body shape and transformation of their physical health.
Yes.
But there are many of us who are as fluent in the literature as our nutritionists are.
Indeed.
And that's not because knowledge is the reason. I mean, I don't need a nutritionist to tell me that, you know, a Streetwise 3 is bad for me.
Absolutely.
But I might need my psychologist to have a conversation with me why it is that I run there after I've had a fight with my partner.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's often missed for me when we are told, you know, go see a nutritionist. Yeah. Go see, I'm taking nothing away. I know some brilliant nutritionists.
Yeah.
There's one I want to see this week and she knows who she is. But I've, even her and I have had the conversation over the last 2-3 years. There are some aspects of our relationship with food that does implicate the work we need to do at a psychological level, not at an information level.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The dietitians and the nutritionists, their level of understanding and their level of knowledge on a nutrition level, on a physiological level of what should go in and what shouldn't go out, obviously that is quite literally their pocket of expertise.
Mm.
But I strongly suspect, I have seen many patients come and they have diets, but they fail.
Mm.
And in that sense, we really start seeing the clinical side, the psychological
Absolutely.
Side. I strongly suspect if you speak to dietitians, nutritionists, they will categorically describe many of their clients or patients that they've told, they understand, and yet they don't follow or nothing changes mm-hmm. and they really hit a wall. And I truly think there is such a connection between the human, us as a whole. To view it only from one angle is really half of the picture.
Absolutely.
One does such a disservice there.
Mm.
It's really about a collaboration of understanding the role.
Including between health professionals.
Indeed.
Absolutely. Rianne, we're going to come to your call on the other side of this.
702 Family Matters.
Rianne, good morning to you. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, you see this. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very lucky. I eat when I'm hungry. I don't eat because it's lunch or dinner or whatever. However, people that I love have got issues with depression and linked to that issues with blood sugar. The combination of those two makes it nearly impossible for them to keep a healthy weight because the compulsion to eat is based on their blood sugar levels, which causes them to have to eat frequently, and then they eat frequently the wrong stuff. And even if they sort out their blood sugar levels, the comfort eating becomes a habit over years. And to break that is extremely difficult because it is linked to the depression.
Mm. Have any of them ever spoken to healthcare professionals, not in the first instance a psychologist, but maybe a clinical nutritionist, for example, also a physician, to test through blood analysis and other kinds of analysis, what is the optimal diet for that individual person's body?
Yes, they have. And like you said just now, all the knowledge is there.
Mm.
But having the knowledge doesn't give you the solution because you are inside your own body.
That's
right. You are so subjectively involved in your own reality day to day, hour to hour. And when you feel hungry, you want to eat.
Yeah.
I am different. I eat when I'm hungry, and that doesn't happen so that often. I can go 15 hours without eating with no problem. My energy level doesn't even drop. But I'm very lucky. And there's other people out there that do not have that type of metabolism.
Mm.
And I feel really sorry for them because people don't understand them. They just say, you fat. You don't go on a diet.
You're lazy. Yeah, pull yourself together.
Whatever.
Yeah.
A thousand different things. Get exercise more. Their mind doesn't work like that, and they can't put these things together
100%.
To get to the solution where they want to maintain a healthy body mass.
Rianne, thanks for your call. Firstly, it underscores something that Hayden is big on the show, which is not to say let's be fatalist about our well-being, but that compassion is very important in the first instance.
Indeed. And I can hear Rianne's concern and his frustration, but I really want to invite you to or him to put himself really deeply in the shoes of those that are struggling. It's really torturous. Even the terms that were highlighted there highlights that group dynamic element that I was referring to earlier. Oh, lazy, fat. It is extremely painful to be disregarded in such a way that any group you are trying to be a part of, you are simply tossed aside from, and no one really gets it unless they are sitting in the same position. It is a torturous situation. Even that plays in on the levels that he is alluding to. If I'm now saying it, and perhaps some people out there will see it a bit and think, sure, yes, that's my experience. But if you think of just even before that, it is such a powerless position to be in that you cannot identify that element. You just feel it. No real escape from it, no real shift in your world, but that pain, And then there's the momentary relief of eating. It is such a trap. Actually, you again were alluding to it earlier with the addictive nature. It really is a mirrored process that we see in addiction without getting a...
I suppose we could do a follow-up show on this and sometime in the future, Aiden. Mm. Both you and I will keep tabs on this one. Mm. And I said this before to one of my other favorite regulars on the show, Janet Gourand, who does work around alcoholism. Mm. And I know Janet gets me, but I don't think she's taking me as seriously as I need you to, Janet, on this point, is that there's some incredibly beautiful, brilliant work in the literature, different organizations, different techniques that have been done the world over for decades and decades now in relation to everything from binge drinking to actually being a clinical alcoholic. Mm. Some of those insights need to travel to food. And I wonder, even in your practice and other psychologists who are listening, whether you get those experiences. Do people even think that, just as I may want to go to my psychologist and talk about my drinking problem, quote unquote, that I could go to you for my food problem? Because some of the techniques that psychologists use to help people think through the consequences of opening a bottle of wine, and I'm being very simplistic here because we're running out of time, but something as simple as Eusebius, next time you feel tempted, try this technique that we've played with in my rooms. Play the movie forward and see how you will, before you make that choice, how will you feel 24 hours later? And something as simple as just a slight cognitive delay can be helpful. Now, if we were to take those kinds of lessons and say, okay, you're about to make this choice of having the Streetwise 3, play the movie forward, even to just an hour from now. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
How psychology invited those lessons to be transposed?
Yes, there are real clinical similarities and overlaps, and certainly the way that we address it does have a lot of similarities. Mm. I must say, for both, if I'm honest, there's such an interplay of different processes occurring on different levels. Mm. That I personally, on a first order level, is where we would refer that to a technique to delay. Mm. Yes, but if one is not looking at the function on a second order level, sure, what we are doing is trying to sweep the tide back with a broom. But it is about simultaneously making second order shifts while addressing first order engagement. A way to engage with the world differently so that one does not need comfort food. Mm-hmm. Adding replacements to comfort food, shifting one's perspective, building in certain levels of assertiveness.
Absolutely.
Even then, on a first order level, using many, many different techniques from different therapeutic paradigms, they're referring to cognitive behavioral techniques. Mm. We even use a lot of hypnosis techniques. But there is a vast toolbox for us to utilize, but it is very delicate work and very individualized because of the intricate nature of it.
If you love Hayden's work, and I know many of you do, you can find out more about what he does and other stuff that he has archived, including from this show. Go to PretoriaPsychologist.com. Hayden, it's lunchtime.
Indeed. Bye-bye.